From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on all the news that made headlines this week. There was a lot to get to. So our panel today includes Joe Parrish, reporter with KTVB Television, Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Statesman, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman opinion writer, and Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press, as well as the voice of the Eye on Boise blog. Happy Friday, everybody.
Oh, happy Friday. We made it through the week.
We did. We are here. All right. Let's start with elections. A lot to break down. I would like, you know, everyone who covered elections to weigh in on this. But Clark, I'll start with you to tee everything up. Not really a surprising night when we look at statewide results.
Yeah, thanks, Gemma, for having us on and for talking about the results. Yeah, it was a big night for Republicans in the Idaho legislature, in the statewide offices, and in the congressional races, as we expected. So there weren't really a whole lot of surprises there. Governor Brad Little was reelected to a second term. Republicans running for statewide office were successful up and down the ballot. And the Idaho legislature, Republicans actually increased their supermajority by one. And a little bit later in the show today, we can talk about why that happened and why that's different than what we initially thought when we were first seeing results on late Tuesday night and early Wednesday morning. I would say, and we've talked about this a little bit, but the biggest surprise for me was the proposed constitutional amendment passing with a narrow majority. That's the amendment, they call it SJR 102, but that's the amendment that will now allow the Idaho legislature to call itself back into session for any reason at any time, as long as they have the votes of 60% of the members of both chambers. So that's the Idaho House and the Idaho Senate. The kind of status quo, the way things had been, is the governor was the only one allowed to call a special session of the Idaho legislature. And that has indeed happened. We had a special session just this year on September 1st. And we also had a special session back in 2020. So to me, that was the biggest real surprise on the ballot this year.
Betsy, your thoughts on that ballot initiative? Were you as surprised as Clark was that it passed?
I was, and it was very close. The results kept seesawing back and forth all night between yes, no, yes, no. And there were two other states, Arkansas and Kentucky, that had similar measures on their ballots. And both of them rejected them pretty decisively. And they were denounced by governors and politicians in both parties in both of those states. Idaho was the only one of the three that passed it. So Idahoans have voted to let the legislature call itself into session whenever it wants, essentially. And we are in for more legislating here in our state. Another election result, actually, that I do want to mention, though, is the College of Western Idaho trustee election, which was noteworthy this year. That's a pretty low-profile position, but it was noteworthy this year because there was a slate of four ultra-conservative candidates who ran as a slate attempting to take over the board and kind of do the same thing that's happened up in at North Idaho College to try to really drastically change the direction, cut the funding, that type of thing. Those candidates failed big time. They all lost. The incumbents won, and the college will proceed as it was. That was a really decisive outcome. It was interesting. It's a nonpartisan race, so it doesn't really play into the, you know, surge of Republican success that we saw overall on the ballot in Idaho, which is certainly anything but unusual in Idaho. Even at Ada County, we saw Republicans roll. And there was one outcome that wasn't clear on election night, but that was by the next morning or very, very late on election night. And that was the county coroner's race, in which, you know, it's not a terribly partisan post. Dottie Owens has been the coroner. Was running for a third term, and she lost very, very narrowly to a Republican challenger. So that's one that was switching really because of party.
You know, Betsy, and I found that to be interesting with Ada County, that really all of these positions went Republican. And in particular, when we look at the results of the CWI Board of Trustees, because you have Ada County and you have Canyon County voting on those, and yes, it's nonpartisan. However, as you mentioned, there was this group that was very vocal about their politics being Republican, and wanting to take over that board. But, you know, there's this idea too, I think that, that Boise is this, you know, blue bubble and parts of it are, but Boise doesn't make up all of Ada County.
That's true. And there are some legislative districts within Ada County that are Democratic and that have been Democratic for a long time. There are some legislative districts that are swing districts. And that brings us to District 15, which was really the most dramatic result that we saw with a Democratic win in the Senate seat. And that was one where the longtime incumbent Republican senator was defeated in the primary by a House member who ran further to the right. And then the incumbent endorsed the Democrat in the general election. And that Democrat, Rick Just, narrowly won the race. So that was a pickup for the Democrats in a Treasure Valley Senate seat. On the other hand, the Democrats lost a Senate seat in North Idaho up in Latah County, where Senator David Nelson lost to former Senator Dan Foreman. So those numbers in the Senate ended up staying exactly as they were before.
Mm-hmm. And Joe, I want to bring you into the conversation. What stood out to you on election night? I know you basically focused on statewide races and the constitutional amendment.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Governor Little touched on it. The Republican Party, you know, has a mandate here in the state of Idaho, but I'm curious what that looks like going forward, because if we go back to the governor's race, yes, we know that Governor Brad Little is going to get a second term, and, you know, far and away, he won that race with 61% of the vote, nearly, you know, 350,000 more than that votes. Interesting, though, if you look further down on the results in the governor's race, Ammon Bundy, the independent in the race, 17% of all Idahoans that voted in this race, over 100,000 Idahoans, said Bundy's our guy. So to me, it's really interesting to see where the Republican Party goes from here. There's clearly a faction that we've heard for months and maybe years about their disappointments or their frustrations with Governor Little and his administration. We see, you know, 100,000 people. That's not a small amount of people. So I'll be interested to see where the Republican Party goes from here in terms of, you know, figuring out, you know, their big tent. Of course, you know, whether it was Tom Luna formerly or Dorothy Moon now, the chairman for the Idaho Republicans, their phrasing is, you know, the Republican Party is a large tent. We include a lot of people. The problem is when you have a lot of people, you know, finding compromise or finding decisions as a party can get complicated. So, you know, the storyline's been here for, you know, a long time. I'm curious, though, where this goes forward in terms of where does the Idaho Republican Party go from here?
Mm-hmm. And Clark and Betsy, maybe you can talk a little bit more about this. I know we've discussed this on the program before, and we have seen infighting within the Republican Party. I mean, the governor fighting with the legislature, right? And it seems to be this more far right faction. So will we be potentially seeing more of that or less of that?
I mean, I think,
forward?
Go ahead, Betsy.
Okay. So I think what we saw, you know, I mentioned that in the Idaho Senate, the partisan breakdown did not change at all, but there was significant change within the Republican caucus in that there are a lot more of the outspoken, further right, ultra-conservative Republicans in that caucus, as opposed to the more mainstream Republicans who had dominated it before. And at the same time in the House, we really didn't see that trend. And we saw some of the most vocal leaders on the far right leave the House, either through election loss, retirement, or moving to the Senate. And so we may see a little bit of a reversal in roles between the two houses as far as which is more moderate and which is more outspoken. But it does seem like there is no end to that split within the Republican Party between basically the conservative and the ultra-conservative and who's further right. And we're going to continue to see that kind of pushback between the legislature and the governor. And of course, now the legislature can call itself into session. We may see differences if the governor issues a veto. Will the legislature override it? They have been reluctant to do that in recent years. I think there's a lot to watch going forward within the Republican Party in Idaho. And when it's so big, of course, that's where the biggest splits are.
Yeah, I totally agree with Betsy. I think the Idaho legislature, with the passage of SJR 102, is the most powerful that I've seen at any point when I've covered it. So any time in the last 12 years, I think the legislature gained power. with the passage of the constitutional amendment. And we heard conservative Republican legislators talk about this all the time during the last two legislative sessions, that they didn't want to be taking a back seat to the executive branch, which means to the governor, the governor's office. I agree that the Senate is likely to become a lot more conservative. It had traditionally been a block or a check on some of the more far-right proposals that had passed the House. We would see those things occasionally never even be heard or never advance in the Idaho Senate. And so with the new conservative members coming in the Senate, I think those dynamics will change. But I agree with Joe and I agree with Betsy. I think there's a split within the Republican Party. And I think we're going to decide or we're going to find out, is the Raul Labrador and Dorothy Moon kind of far right wing of the party taking more control? Or is the more traditional establishment Brad Little and Scott Bedke wing of the Republican Party still in charge? And so I think we're going to see some of those clashes during the legislative session. We have a whole ton of brand new legislators who have never served before in the legislature, 39 first timers who have never held office in the Idaho legislature. And if you look at people who haven't been in office for a little bit or maybe switched between chambers, then the number of new legislators who are in a different role next year grows to 51 out of 105 legislators total. I think as reporters, we're going to have our hands full keeping an eye on the legislative session. I think it's going to be unpredictable. And I agree with Betsy and Joe that we continue to have this identity crisis almost within the Republican Party and a power struggle. So it'll be really interesting politically from a political standpoint to watch it unfold.
And just to add on to that, too, you know, as Clark was touching on, the Idaho House will also have a new House Speaker, you know, with Scott Bedke being elected lieutenant governor. It'd be really interesting to me, you know, number one, who is the House Speaker? Two, you know, what type of a House show do they run? Scott Bedke, the longest running House Speaker in state history, you know, we kind of knew what to expect going into that. And as Clark just talked about, with so many new faces and so much in leadership, again, the House Speaker will be brand new. What will that look like? I'm so, you know, fascinated to see how this all plays out.
It's going to be certainly interesting, I think. So, Brian, there was also an advisory question on Tuesday's ballot, and you wrote about this, but can you fill us in on what it was and kind of what's happening now with it potentially?
Sure. So the advisory question was just a question that was put to voters, and it regarded what happened during the special session where a significant amount of funding was set aside both for tax cuts and for education spending increases. The tax cuts were able to be finalized, but all they could really do with the education money was sort of put it to the side and say that it's intended to be used for education. They couldn't go through the actual appropriations process during the special session. So the sort of the purpose of the advisory question was to allow voters to express support or opposition to the idea behind that special session, this idea of taking the budget surplus and spending it on a combination of tax cuts and education funding increases. Now, this was actually the most popular question on the statewide ballot. It passed with just under 80% support, and that's almost 10 points higher than the most popular statewide candidate. So the opinion piece that we wrote, our editorial board wrote, basically took the position that, you know, the clearest position that voters have taken in this election is that money needs to be spent on education, not diverted for other purposes in the coming legislative session when you'll have all of these new lawmakers coming in, as other participants have been discussing.
And any other thoughts on that, maybe Clark or Betsy or Joe, when it comes to, you know, I think the resounding yes on that advisory question.
Yeah, yeah. That surprised me a little bit, but I'll let Betsy take it from here.
It was surprising. I thought that it got 80%. I mean, that's really, really high. On the other hand, the wording was basically, we did a great thing. Do you want to pat us on the back? but I guess when I first looked at the wording before the election, I thought there might be kind of a snarky reaction to that, you know, that voters mm-hmm. would say, nah, we're not going to tell you you're so great. But what we saw instead was a real vote of confidence for, as Brian mentioned, putting that money into education. And now if the legislature were to try to change course and veer off and divert that money to something else, which the law now says has to go to education, they would not only be departing from what the law is and changing it drastically, they would be departing from what 80% of the voters wanted them to do. So the governor really set it up this way by including the advisory measure in the legislation that passed in the September 1st special session in order to allow the voters to weigh in. And because the voters gave such a clear mandate in favor of it, I think that puts a ton of pressure on the legislature to follow through and to do what that law says they have to do.
And one reason why that's important, sort of a technical detail that not everyone might know, is that there's a general rule that one legislature can't bind a following legislature. So it's not possible for them to pass a law during this special session that can't then be changed in the next session. So the only way to really try and keep them pointed in the same direction is to apply this kind of popular pressure or popular discipline. We'll see how effective it was, but the people spoke very clearly on Tuesday. 80% is about as high a result as I've seen on anything.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, I want to bring you into the conversation. What in the world is going on with my pillow guy, Mike Lindell, and frankly, causing a big old headache for election workers in Idaho?
Yeah, so it was a bit surprising to, write a local story that included Mike Lindell, but interesting nonetheless. So in a public records request I made to the Ada County and Canyon County elections offices, I found that many of the records requests were all requesting the same thing, something called a cast vote record, which I had never heard of before. And it turns out that until recently, many of the elections officials hadn't heard of ever before. So we found that around the same time that Mike Lindell hosted a moment, he called it the Moment of Truth Summit. He had urged people watching and attending to request these cast vote records from their elections offices. And I mean, I don't think I have to really tell anyone, Mike Lindell, CEO of MyPillow, he's known for peddling false theories that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump. And, you know, since then has kind of pushed the message that there's voter fraud and ballot manipulation happening. So he urged his followers, some of those people being Idahoans, to request these records from their elections offices. And it turns out that Ryan Supe, my colleague at the Idaho Statesman, and I talked to Phil McGrain at the Ada County Elections Office and Chad Houck in the Secretary of State's office. And you know, Idaho doesn't have, our elections machines don't have these cast vote records, which is basically a document that says what the ballot counted as your votes, what the machine counted as your votes. So it's basically just a document that shows how you voted. And it turns out that Idaho doesn't have these. So we have dozens of records requests going into the elections offices. Many of these requests, Phil McGrain told us, have to be looked at by high-ranking people in the elections office. So it takes a lot of time. And, you know, as everyone, many people know, the Secretary of State does audits now of counties' ballots. And this year in Ada County, they found a perfect match between the hand counted ballots and what the machine counted. So basically Phil McGrain and Chad Houck told us that even if Idaho had these cast vote records, it wouldn't show any kind of ballot manipulation in Idaho. So that's where we are. And you know, in our conversation with the Secretary of State, he told us that, you know, this is something they see often from these summits and forums, is that people usually have this idea that every state operates in the same way for elections. Like Colorado, they said, uses a cast vote record, but Idaho does not. So many people assume that we all do it the same way, but that is not the case.
So bottom line, all of these records requests, public records requests coming in for something that we don't do in the state of Idaho.
Okay. Yes.
So just causing much more work for our elections officials.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So a lot of requests before the election. So people had to respond to these requests while also prepping for a pretty big election.
Yeah. Betsy, tell us what is going on with current Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan. She is facing some possible penalties. And is this in regards to people saying that she may have used taxpayer money?
Yes. So the lieutenant governor, who, of course, is a lame duck, she didn't run for re-election, and there's now been a new lieutenant governor elected, and she has already overrun her budget, has been sending out emailed electronic newsletters. And a couple of her newsletters most recently included advocating for the slate of far-right candidates who were running to take over the College of Western Idaho board, and really slamming all of the Republicans who endorsed Tom Arcush in the attorney general race against Raul Labrador, and taking very vocal positions, calling them turncoat Republicans and mutinous and so on. And there was a citizen complaint filed that this was taxpayer funds being used for electioneering by sending out these formal office newsletters, taking these positions. Oh, she also advocated in favor of SJR 102. So she was taking positions on candidates and ballot measures in taxpayer-funded publications that were going out from her office. And after the citizen complaint was filed, there was an investigation, and the attorney general's office ended up sending her two cease and desist letters saying to stop doing this and to remove this information from her office website by a deadline of noon on Monday. Now, by that time, she did remove the archive of her newsletters, the link to the archive of her newsletters from her official website. But the newsletters are all still out there. They're all on her official Lieutenant Governor Facebook page. It's not clear yet whether her action to remove that link to the archive satisfied the threat of seeking penalties and prosecution or not. There is an Integrity in Elections Act that forbids using public funds for electioneering in Idaho, and that is what she was alleged to have violated.
And Betsy, let's talk a little bit more about what she was saying in regards to the attorney general's race and Republicans backing the Democratic candidate, Tom Arcush. This really was unprecedented in our state that a Republican backed a Democrat, but so many Republicans backed this candidate.
Right. And it's funny, I've seen a lot of reports because I had written that there were more than 50 Republicans who came out and endorsed him when he announced this Republicans for Arcush. And I counted the names and there were more than 50. Most of the other reports have said almost 50. And some of those were very, very prominent Idaho Republicans, like former Republican Governor Phil Batt, who is a former Idaho Republican Party chairman, former Republican, longtime Idaho Secretary of State Ben Assersa. It was a very long list of well-known and respected people. And Raul Labrador directly addressed that on election night in his victory speech at the Republican campaign watch night party, in some really scathing language, saying that he has a message that everyone should stop listening to those 50 Republicans who think they're relevant because they're not relevant. And basically he, Raul Labrador, is the future of the Idaho Republican Party. So everyone in Idaho should simply reject all the former governors and longtime leaders in the party who disagree with Raul Labrador because Labrador is the only one who represents the future of the Republican Party. That's an interesting way to look at the future of the party when we have such a divided party. But that was what we heard.
Yeah, no, it was a very interesting take, I think. So, Brian, the Idaho Statesman recently did a poll, and you looked at not just abortion rights, but really Idahoans' thoughts and beliefs in regards to abortion rights. And I think it's fair to say that what you found may be a bit surprising in regards to, I think, the rhetoric that we hear about how Idahoans feel about this.
That's right. We asked a variety of questions, and it's not too surprising that you know, when you just ask Idahoans, you know, do you support or oppose abortion, you do wind up with a majority who are opposed to it sort of in general in the abstract. But the details matter a lot. And this is something we've known nationally for quite a long time. There are actually very few people who hold a very polarized view on abortion, either that it should be allowed in all cases or that it should be banned in all cases or virtually all cases. And so we asked a wide variety of questions to a large sample of Idaho voters, and we found some really large mismatches between Idaho's public policy on abortion and the policy that the state has implemented. Some that I think people would find very surprising is that majorities, even of Republicans, don't think women should face any criminal penalties for abortion. In the legislature, you commonly hear that it should be charged as murder, though that's not a majority position there even. But a majority of Idaho Republicans don't think women should face criminal penalties, and actually a plurality don't even think the doctor should face a criminal penalty. That was 49% compared to 32. So you know, what does that leave? That leaves something like a suspended license at the most. Mm-hmm. But Idaho's current law makes it a felony, punishable by 2 to 5 years imprisonment. And so I think the overall takeaway is that even though Idaho is a red state, its population has a much more nuanced and much more moderate view on abortion policy than that you see reflected in the legislature.
Mm-hmm. I think, Brian, this survey was very interesting, especially when we look at what happened across the country on Election Day, when there were abortion right issues on the ballot. And in particular, I mean, looking at Kentucky, right? It is a deep red state. And there was an initiative on the ballot to keep abortion rights in place, and it passed. And it's interesting because I think there may be things to learn from what happened on Tuesday across the country in regards to how people, no matter their religious affiliation, no matter their political affiliation, believe in regards to access to abortion care.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's similar to the results we also saw in Kansas before that. Mm-hmm. So these are both very red states. And it turns out there's quite a bit of opposition to very harsh abortion policy. Now that's particularly relevant in Idaho because Idaho currently has some of the harshest abortion laws in the country. Some of them are held up in the courts right now. Included in those would be the what we've called the bounty law, the one that would allow relatives to sue. Now that had almost no support. That had 12% support among Idaho voters. It's difficult to think of a more unpopular policy than that, but that overwhelmingly passed the legislature. So it might be time for lawmakers to take a look at what their constituents actually believe as a whole, rather than just listening to the loudest voices in the room.
Right. Well, and Clark, that may not happen, right? When it comes to our legislature, we have seen that. With that said, though, Terry Pickens-Manweiler, who was the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor, she lost her race on Tuesday evening to soon-to-be Lieutenant Governor Scott Bedke. She has come out saying that she will now be spending all of her energy, it sounds like, on abortion rights.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so if the Idaho legislature doesn't take a look at it, the people of Idaho may get a say in an upcoming election. But Gemma, you're absolutely right. Terry Pickens-Manweiler is a Boise attorney. She finished second in the lieutenant governor's race. And immediately after the results were in, she announced plans to begin working on a ballot initiative for the state of Idaho that, if it's successful and qualifies for the ballot for an upcoming election, would give Idahoans a chance to vote on what they think should happen with abortion rights rather than let the legislature decide it. When I talked to Terry, she said the real work is going to begin in January after the holidays and after Christmas. She's already talking about partnering with the National Organization for Women and Planned Parenthood Advocates of the West. What she wants to do is repeal Idaho's abortion statutes, including the civil bounty law that Brian talked about that gives family members the right to sue the healthcare provider who performs abortion, as well as the criminal laws, the near total abortion ban for the state of Idaho. She said she's going to work with Democratic State Senator Melissa Wintrow and House Minority Leader Ilana Rubel, both of them are Boise Democrats, to draft language and to kind of come up with the specifics on what she would like to do. So that's a brand new effort. As we know, ballot initiatives do face a tough road in Idaho to even qualify mm-hmm. for the ballot. The rules are now you have to get 6% of signatures of 6% of registered voters in 18 of the state's 35 legislative districts, as well as signatures from 6% of the voters statewide. And the Idaho legislature over the years has taken several steps to try to restrict the ballot initiative and the referendum process. But if you remember, in August 2021, there was an Idaho Supreme Court ruling that tossed out the more strict ballot initiative law and ruled that ballot initiatives and referendums are, quote, fundamental rights reserved to the people of Idaho. And so we expect that abortion and abortion rights will be big topics of discussion in the 2023 legislative session. It also looks like a big ballot initiative is going to get underway starting in January. So that'll be really interesting to cover and really interesting to see where that goes. And we're probably going to have, you know, it's going to be at odds with the Republican-controlled Idaho legislature. And so it'll be really interesting to see where it goes. But I think that the survey results that Brian had talked about are really interesting. And Terry is very confident that this could succeed in Idaho. So stay tuned. And I know that we will all follow that and cover that closely, as well as the policy developments from the session itself.
And this issue has played a really significant role in Idaho politics in the past. And it's worth looking back to 1990, the last time that the Idaho legislature passed what would have been the nation's strictest anti-abortion law. It was vetoed by then Governor Cecil Andrus. And following that, in the next election, Democrats had the biggest surge in success in Idaho that they have had since. And the Idaho Senate came out split, half Democrat, half Republican. So right now, with such Republican dominance in our state, it's hard kind of to imagine Republican or Democrats having a big surge. But the last time it happened, it was the abortion issue that prompted it.
And if this does move forward, Clark, so Terry Pickens Manweiler is saying come January, she will really start, rolling out this plan. Would it then have to be the 2024 election cycle where we would potentially see this on the ballot? I mean, if they are able to get it to that point.
Yeah, potentially, for sure. Terry doesn't have any hard deadlines and still really going to get geared up in January. But I think 2024 potentially makes sense because of the amount of time you have to gather the signatures and attempt to qualify it for the ballot. That's not locked in yet. That's not final. This really is just about to get underway. But that is a potential option for sure, Gemma. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anyone should be surprised that this would potentially become a ballot initiative in Idaho. We've seen this in other states as well. Rachel, I want to shift gears a little bit because you wrote a story recently about Idaho farm workers. And what was so poignant about this is when we talk about inflation and we talk about how it's impacting folks, you know, gas prices, grocery bills, our farm workers are struggling.
Yeah, they absolutely are. I mean, you know, the minimum wage for farm workers in Idaho is still $7.25, so that hasn't moved. And many farm workers in Idaho are making $13 to $15 an hour, which, I mean, we've all like driven down the highways and seen signs and been to restaurants who are seeking employees for $17 to $20 an hour, you know, so, mm-hmm. you know, other wages seem to be kind of relatively keeping up with inflation, but farm worker wages are not. And on top of that, you know, we all know that farm labor requires, you know, working with dangerous equipment, extreme heat, other extreme weather events. And, you know, the two women farm workers I talked to sometimes work 30-hour shifts, you know, with no overtime. So they're really struggling. You know, the two women I talked to, you know, one of them said that she's going to food banks instead of, you know, shopping for groceries on her own. You know, she's lucky that she rents a room in her friend's house for a relatively low rent. But, you know, she said if she had to be paying the rents that we're seeing in the Valley, 800 plus for a single room, you know, she would not be able to make it work. You know, and one thing I wanted to point out on this too, is that the two women I talked to, you know, I think we often think of, you know, farm labor as this like, you know, really grueling thing that only a few people want to do. But the two women I talked to like really enjoy the work. They like working outside. And so, you know, their thing is just that they want to get paid enough to do a job that they enjoy and also be able to afford to feed their families, afford rent, you know, things that all of us want to do. So, yeah, it was really interesting to talk to those farm workers and see that, you know, many of their wages are not keeping up with inflation. And they also have to pay for all of the things that you and I have to pay for that are growing more and more expensive.
Mm-hmm. So, Clark, tell us about an error that happened, I believe, at the Secretary of State's office. So it looked like there was a legislative seat that would go to a Republican, but ultimately went to a Democrat.
So I think it's actually the other way around. But yeah, this was a confusing issue that happened in Jerome County. And I want to give a tip of the cap to Kelsey Mosley Morris from the Idaho Capital Sun, who had this story. And it gets a little complicated, but you can check it out at idahocapitalsun.com. What they're saying is the count was actually correct in Jerome County, but the results were incomplete when they were updated to the Secretary of State's office. And so what actually happened, it applies to Legislative District 26, which includes a couple of three different counties in kind of south central Idaho. Originally, on election night, it appeared that the Democrat, Karma Metzler Fitzgerald, won a close race. But what happened was, after going back and looking at the records, they did not upload the early voting results on the Secretary of State's website. And so that actually changed the result. Instead, Republican Jack Nelson won the race. And now we're going to have Idaho Republicans pick up a gain of one seat in the legislature in the Idaho House. So they're saying the count was actually correct. The hand count, the official record was correct, but it was uploaded incorrectly to the Secretary of State's website. When Kelsey talked to state election officials, they pointed out that this is a good reminder that no election results are official in the state of Idaho until they've been counted, canvassed, and certified. The counties are going to be doing that process over the next week, and then the deadline for the Idaho State Board of Canvassers to certify election results is November 23rd. And so it's a reminder that all these results that we report on and that we see on election night and election week are all unofficial until the state certification, which is going to be coming up towards the end of the month on November 23rd. But they're saying the count was right, but they uploaded the results wrong to the Idaho Secretary of State's website, and they left out the early voting results. And if Brian or Betsy or Joe has anything else to add on that one, I'll let them clean up.
I think you covered it pretty well, Clark. It was a big surprise to me that the results changed after they said they were final and official. And we all know they're always unofficial until the canvass. I mean, that's still, I think, a week away. So we got to see that. It did raise a question as to how this happened, whether they have a plan to make sure it doesn't happen again. it's an unfortunate thing to have happen at a time when there are so many questions about election integrity, because we know that election integrity has been tested in Idaho and has come out strong. But having one result come out and then having it flip to a different result kind of undermines people's belief in that. So it's probably something that the election officials will take a lesson from and try to avoid in the future.
Right. Yeah.
And
go ahead, Brian.
I would only add that it's not the only time that something like this has happened. I recall a couple of years ago, a rather similar thing happening with the race up in Fremont County that initially showed Kerry Hanks losing. But then with all of the precincts reporting, but then it turned out that all the precincts were not in fact in. And the next morning, it turned out Kerry Hanks had won.
Hmm. So I want to be done with elections for now. I'm sure, there is much to talk about as we head into the legislative session. But Joe, wrap us up on this Friday with Treefort releasing some of its lineup for 2023. I know that folks, man, they buy their tickets even before they know who's coming.
This yeah, and there's some huge event. Names coming to Boise, yeah. And I think there's one name that a lot of people were probably excited about, and that's Annie DeFranco. She is a feminist icon. She won a Grammy. She's really a huge part of the DIY scene, and she's actually one of the first artists to create their own record label back in 1990. But this upcoming addition to Treefort, it's going to be unique, and I was talking with Eric Gilbert, who's one of the co-founders of the festival, one of the directors of the festival, and it's really like this really interesting point in the sense that this is decade two and they get to kind of redefine what Treefort is now in its 11th year. And the main stage, as many people have heard already, the main stage is moving from downtown Boise over to Julia Davis Park. And they're really excited about that. One very practical thing I spoke with Eric about yesterday is that, you know, dancing on grass and partying on grass, it's a little easier on the body than on the concrete and on the sidewalks. So it'll be really interesting. And another thing that I took away from my conversation with Eric is that they're really doubling down on the family-friendly aspect of Treefort with so many great things near Julia Davis Park, like the Boise Zoo and Kid Fort. They're really trying to reinvest into that and get everybody involved in it. So it should be really exciting. Also, a little bit of news I got from Eric yesterday. If you aren't aware of this, the Treefort Music Hall, which is going to be a brand new venue in downtown Boise, it's now on the spot in Bodo that used to be Office Max or Office Depot. Mm-hmm. I don't remember which one it is. They're working on it. And they tell me, Gemma, the plan is to have that venue open and operating by March as a big part of Treefort. So there's going to be a lot of great artists. Godspeed You Black Emperor is also coming, which is an awesome, awesome Canadian band. So the Unknown Mortal Orchestra from Portland and New Zealand. It's going to be a really great festival, and I'm excited to see it and what it looks like too.
Well, and I have to say, just on a selfish note, I'm glad that all the streets won't be closed off in downtown Boise during it. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. Thank you so much for spending an hour with us. I know you're all busy, so much appreciation to all of you. Our panel today, Joe Parrish, reporter with KTVB Television, Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Statesman, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman opinion writer, and Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press, as well as the voice of the I Am Boise blog. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Experiencing the news each day can feel like a journey. With Up First from NPR, it doesn't have to be. Welcome to 15 easy minutes of breaking news, clarity on international and national affairs, all handed over not from some floating voice in the sky, from us, Layla, A, Steve, and me, Rachel. Start your day informed. Subscribe to Up First wherever you get your podcasts.